This is 8 Minutes, a podcast helping you understand the energy and climate challenge in just a few minutes. I'm your host, Paul Schuster. Financing the energy transition is tough. The sheer amount of dollars that are going to be needed can be daunting, but it's more than that. Some of the technologies being proposed, such as hydrogen or virtual power plants or nuclear fusion, these are still maturing technologies, and private financing is often risk-averse from backing such new opportunities. Or consider households that want to install solar panels or heat pumps, but their credit isn't quite high enough to entice a bank to offer them the loan needed to make it happen. This is where green banks come in. These quasi-public institutions bridge that financing gap and make more projects happen faster. Today, I'll discuss a bit about how these specialized institutions work and the impact that they're having on the energy transition. 8 minutes. It's how long it takes the sun's rays to hit Earth, or about how long Atlanta Falcon fans enjoyed this past week's NFL draft. Not a lot of happy faces in Georgia after the Falcons bungled their first round pick. Anyways, let's get it on. The first green bank in the nation opened up in Connecticut in 2011. And since then, over 20 additional green banks have been formed, with the goal of catalyzing energy transition investment. These green banks sit in an interesting space in energy financing. They aren't traditional banks. You or I can't go and deposit money into them, and they don't necessarily invest that capital into profit-oriented endeavors. Rather, green banks are quasi-public institutions funded by the state to advance the deployment of clean energy projects. Given some of the challenges that these projects can have in obtaining capital through traditional private channels, green banks enable projects to get over that financing hump and actually get developed. Green banks are able to address certain risks that the private banking market just can't. Private institutions are set up as profit-making entities, so they look at projects with a certain lens. Green banks, though, are designed to deploy clean energy technologies, to break down barriers to equitable access, to increase local economic development through the clean energy economy. That's not to say that they give money away, but they're willing to backstop projects that ordinary banks may not want to. Consider the DC Green Bank, which offers a commercial property assessed clean energy program, a CPACE program. That mechanism allows the DC Green Bank to loan capital to commercial buildings who are going to implement energy efficiency and distributed resource projects on their facility. And then the bank gets paid back over time, typically structured as a portion of the energy savings that the facility is creating. Or think about households that want to invest in solar or heat pumps, but their credit rating is too low for traditional financing. This is where green banks step in to provide a credit backstop, essentially ensuring that the bank that does provide the loan is going to get paid at the end of the day. If the homeowner defaults, the green bank steps in and pays on their behalf. Or green banks can provide low-cost lending for clean energy projects that, for whatever reason, can't find similar capital through traditional channels. Is the technology too immature? The offtake market too volatile? A green bank may be able to bring to bear the financial instruments necessary to bridge that risk that the private market was unwilling to take. No green bank is set up the same as any other. So not all of those examples apply to every green bank, but they do all have the common characteristic of promoting clean energy deployment by using public funds to catalyze further private investment. The Connecticut Green Bank estimates that for every dollar that they invest, it leverages an additional $7 of private capital. And with that type of success at the state level, it's been a goal of climate activists to establish a national green bank that could accelerate these activities even further. And the IRA and the IIJA delivered on that ambition in two ways. The first was a very straightforward establishment of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. The IRA funded this with $27 billion, and that's an enormous pool of public funds that will be deployed with three main areas of focus. First, $7 billion to disadvantaged communities to help address that credit risk that I mentioned before. An additional $8 billion in direct loans to those communities, even beyond that credit backstop. And $12 billion to directly help finance greenhouse gas reductions. So I'm reading that as direct loans to projects to get them off the ground. The EPA, tasked with administering the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, announced $20 billion in awards to 8 fortunate recipients just earlier in April. The ambition is that these funds will spur tens of thousands of clean energy projects with a goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 40 million metric tons per year. And the remaining $7 billion was announced last week as under the Solar for All initiative, which is designed for low-income and disadvantaged households to access solar energy. Those federal dollars could unlock hundreds of billions of dollars in additional private investment. In addition to the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, though, the federal government, through the IRA, but also through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, also opened up additional capital, a lot of additional capital. Here, the IRA tapped the Department of Energy's Loan Program Office, the LPO, as a catalyst for these investments. Under its original authority, the LPO had a ton of money, but relatively limited ability to use it. They were kind of stuck doing two things, either providing a loan guarantee for a borrower who takes out a loan from a private lender, or backstopping a direct loan to the project that comes from the federal financing bank. And the LPO was limited to just those projects that were using innovative, not yet commercialized energy technologies. What the IIJA did was to widen the scope of what the LPO could invest behind. Now, any project that reduces greenhouse gases can be eligible for support. And what the IRA did was supercharge that effort by dropping an additional $40 billion on top of the $70 billion or so that the LPO already had. Those two pieces of legislation kind of set the LPO up to be something of a shadow green bank. Okay, probably the wrong word to use, but the point is that the organization has immense ability to fund technology into projects that, quite simply, would never have been capitalized otherwise. Whether green banks are managed at the state level or through these federal organizations, they play an important role in the energy transition. The gap between what is theoretically financeable and actually financeable is often dismissed or thought to be minimal. In actuality, it's anything but, and that gap has delayed a lot of really great projects from making it to market. What green banks do is bridge that risk gap, backstopping efforts that private banks can't in order for meaningful climate projects to proceed forward. I'm Paul Schuster, and this has been your 8 Minutes.